This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, welcome back. We are missing Dr. Hawk, but it's just you and me solo today, Dr. Lyle.
Cool. Thank God I can get a word in edgewise now. That's actually even funnier than you think, because we just did a show with AJ a few days ago, of which that my questions, I couldn't keep my corn pecker out of the questions. So I probably talked about 75% of that hour. Jen, just totally good sport. It was all good, cool. But yeah, now I'm going to take 100%. What the hell?
Well, we call that Doug-splaining,
and there you go. That's what it is.
Legal here.
That's
on
it.
This show.
That's it. That's all good. All right. How are things going there, Nathan?
It's going great. Okay, it's going great. But to the listeners, we will have Dr. Hawk back probably next show or the next show after that. So no problem. We'll have both of you guys back again. So,
yeah. All right.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, there's not any current events to share other than I just need to sneak it in there that the CDC just quietly released the fact that half of Americans essentially have been infected with COVID and already have natural immunity. But you know, that's for a different show, I guess.
Yeah. there's a lot. There's so much to say about COVID, and we've been such a long time since we ever talked that much about it that it seems kind of coming out of left field to talk about it. But you know, there one very interesting thing that is happening is obviously a showdown in the courts with the vax mandate. So I, like any reasonable person, doesn't have any problem with people taking the vaccine or not taking the vaccine. I do have a problem with the government forcing people to take the vaccine for their children to go to school or for them to keep their job. That an employer could reasonably require anything of an employee, but it's not fair when the government basically intimidates businesses so that businesses do this and does their bidding. So this is this is very, very nasty behavior on the part of our government. Obviously, it's worse than other governments. As this week, Austria is now, the unvaccinated people are now locked down. So you're watching unbelievably unprecedented aggressive behavior worldwide on the part of basically totalitarian actions on the part of governments. The United States hasn't done anything like that, but the vax mandate is on its way to that, in other words. But it looks like, from all appearances, are magnificently, inherently conservative. And I don't mean that in a political sense. I mean in a sense of very, very slow-moving changes to the law. It's the way our system is designed. In other words, it's a very careful, very slow nitpicking around legal issues. And that's how our country is designed legally. And this vax mandate looks like it's completely dead on arrival, that it violates numerous clauses in the Constitution, and it doesn't look like it's going to fly. So still, I feel very bad for all the people that got intimidated into taking a shot that they didn't want to take. Let's hope that the shots are reasonably benign physically, so that people didn't have damages done to them from doing something that they didn't want to do, but they felt like they had to. So I'm sure that will happen. I'm sure there will be bad things that will happen. And all we can hope is that on balance, that the entire thing isn't a major public health fiasco as we learn more about the vaccines and their costs and benefits. But as of right now, I'm cheered by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals that took one look at this thing and wrote an extensive opinion basically saying that it's not that this is even close legally, that the federal government isn't on even remotely solid ground when it comes to demanding this of its citizens. And a beautiful statement in writing the opinion, one of the justices wrote something, I won't quote it accurately, Nathan, but it said something to the effect of the fact that politicians are frustrated with individual citizens is actually, this is the entire point of having a free society. In other words, opinion, that is precisely why we have the Bill of Rights, is when the government is frustrated with citizens because the citizens aren't doing what the government wants. This society was predicated on the notion that the government governs at the consent of the governed, that we are in charge, not you. Okay? And so this is a very interesting legal showdown, and I believe the present administration is going to get creamed on this whole thing. But they will have pushed people, and they will have gotten their way a long ways, but they're not going to capture the flag. And I'm glad to see that. All right. This is a very direct libertarian argument that is, in fact, the libertarian argumentation is, or the philosophy is, really at the root of the American Revolution. The whole point of government is to free men from men and to have people free from governmental edicts. And this is absolutely an absurd concept that they're attempting to enforce. And it needs to be, you know, a free society would shoot it down. And the very first legitimate shot that gets fired, the justices hit the center of the target. They didn't apologize and mealy mouth anything about it. They aimed dead center at this thing and said, it is fatally flawed. And so that is, the odds in my estimation that any appeal to the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court even bothers to take this piece of shit case, but if they do, I believe that the Supreme Court will overwhelmingly deny this appeal. So that's where we are. And, you know, if you don't want the shot, put your hand over your shoulder, put your hand over your bicep, because you're not going to have to do it unless you've got an employer that unfortunately is buying into this and bowing their heads, which hopefully now fewer and fewer employers will. All right. That's my little statement on that, Nathan. And
awesome.
Yeah.
It came out of, yeah, I know I brought it up out of left field, but
yeah, it's
just,
okay.
You know, this had been on my mind.
No, all good. Yeah, that's the for
it
me.
It turned out you were right. I mean, a year and a half ago, you were right about the how deadly this thing might have been, looked like. So.
Well, you know, certainly I made plenty of mistakes. There's been a lot of mistakes made. There's a lot of uncertainty that remains, and there's a lot of territory ahead of us that we have not yet traversed. So. There's a lot to do, but one thing that shouldn't happen is we shouldn't turn this into a totalitarian dictatorship behind this. I was moved by listening to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and I had not ever seen him, and it harkened back to my childhood because I could see his father in him, and his father was actually kind of a boyhood hero of mine. And so, and to see RFK saying, basically, hey, listen, it's a deadly virus, but it's not that deadly. And, you know, there is there's treatment, there's personal responsibility, and there's overwhelmingly likelihood that the overwhelming majority of citizens would survive. And he said, thank God that, you know, in 1776, a bunch of people got together that said, you know what, there are things that are worse than death. And that we are not going to be enslaved. Not going to happen. Okay, so there are freedoms that we are going to protect, even if it means we die trying. And to for us to roll over and hand over those freedoms behind this is ridiculous. And it was a very moving sequence that he was sharing. And so I was proud of him. I said, there's a great thinker. All right. That's enough for one day on that. Let's move on to something that anybody wants to hear about.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Okay. So our first question, dear doctors, why do I often get small epiphanies about various things in my life when I'm half asleep? There's a trope that epiphanies often come to people in the middle of a restless night or when they've just woken up. I used to think this was just an invention of the media to make their content more entertaining, but I've started believing that it might be a real occurrence now that I've been experiencing it for the past 2 years. What are your thoughts on this?
Let me explain what's happening. So there's a lot to explain there, and obviously a lot of what I'm going to be saying is somewhat speculative, but there's actually quite a lot of science around it, and a lot of thinking about this has been sort of coalesced quite well over the last decade or so. So it's going to turn out that there's sort of two ways to solve problems. So I'm sure I've talked about this before, but we'll answer this very good question. Probably answered it 4 years ago, but everybody forgot. So there's going to be two basic processes by which the mind is going to solve problems. One of them is going to be what we're going to call analytic, and the other one's going to be what we call holistic. And so they're different mental processes. So let me explain what this looks like. So let's suppose that you're trying to solve a problem, in chemistry. And so you're looking at, every little piece of every little molecule and how it would fit. And you need all of these little disparate facts in order to solve it. And so what you do is that you try to look at the interrelationships between the little disparate facts, and you look for the pattern about how it works. And your brain, as you are working and maneuvering around in your mind's eye how things would fit, you'll see little solutions. And in fact, oftentimes, like let's suppose that you're a geometry student and you know your geometry quite well, you look at the need for a proof on something, and you're thinking, okay, well let me look at what element that is. Okay, so we've got side angle side, and then angle side angle, and then we've got parallelogram, and therefore the angles are the same, et cetera, et cetera. And so you know little pieces of the rules of geometry. And you can very quickly maneuver them around and then put them in a sequence, and then got it, okay? That is analytic. Now, the holistic problems are going to have all kinds of little elements, a lot of which you don't see how they tie together. And so you can run into a problem where, for example, you're working in the little elements inside of an analytic problem. And let's say, it's the double helix. Okay? So you're trying to figure out how this thing works. And then you look across the room and some gal starts walking out of the room, but she puts her jacket on and zips up the zipper. You can imagine that in another universe on a different day and time, a Francis Crick or a John Watson would take a look at that. Was it James Watson? James Watson would have looked at that and said, God, that's it. It's a zipper. Okay. So in other words, a something else in the universe is applied to that problem. And essentially a neural circuit far out away from the tight analytic thing that you were looking at actually holds the solution. Very different part of your brain somewhere. Now, when you are working on the analytic side, working down in the immediate details that you think are responsible for the action that you need to understand how things interrelate, when you're doing that, it turns out that your brain is searching all over its vast library, its vast knowledge of memories inside of you, about looking for anything that is relevant to this problem. Okay. It's looking for conversations you had with your Uncle Ben, you know, when you poked the fireplace. It's looking for, you know, the fact that you had a Christmas train track that you built in your room and you built a figure eight. Okay. It's looking all over the place. You can't see it because the neural circuits that are being activated don't arise in consciousness. They don't arise in consciousness because the mystery of how it is that these values are all held together and activated, it's not exciting enough. The system doesn't see that it's a solution. But somewhere in its meanderings, it may trip over something. The thing is, it may trip over a hint of it, but if it's got a hint of something and it starts to trip, but you are absolutely full focused on the analytic parts of what you're looking at, it may not arise to consciousness and you miss it. Okay, now, however, later on, when you go 3 hours later, you go, I don't know, bicycling around your neighborhood, and you come back in, you take a shower, and you're just in the shower, fiddling around, just relaxing, and then boom, suddenly it arrives in consciousness. Why did that happen? Because the analytic part of the mind was kind of put to sleep. It's dominating the action all over the whole system. It's like you got two different kinds of music going on in the room, but one of them is five times as loud. You can barely hear the other music. It's there, but you might not be able to hear it at all. Okay? When you shut the big music down, suddenly you can hear the other music. And that's what happens with very far away, essentially, pattern recognition, because that's what all information is it's the recognition of pattern. And so somewhere out there in the faint reaches of your memory system, that there has been a pattern recognition event that the circuits amazingly can tell, hey, wait a second, that could be relevant. Okay. And then when it's tripping around it and those neural circuits are lighting up and they're getting more activation around them as it's moving the little pieces in imagination, all this outside of your awareness, suddenly in a flash, the original neural circuits that were working on the original problem under the analytic process that are all very hot and sitting there waiting and they're tapping their feet and they're looking to actually close the loop of their frustrated lack of understanding. That's an interesting characteristic of problem solving, is that it's frustrating to have a problem half solved or not completely solved. The mind recognizes probably the cost benefit. You wouldn't even be working on the problem if it didn't seem like it had a worthwhile enough prize. And so when you get close, you get pieces, you have a sense that this is solvable, but you're missing something. That you're just missing one little piece of this, or there's an element that you're not identifying, but there is a pattern. If we could actually recognize and understand this thing, that it's going to be significant. It's going to be significantly useful. It's going to be a leap forward in our understanding. So, problem is that when you have worked on something, you have activated standing orders in the nervous system to look for little relational memories. But when you are directly working on the problem, you can't access a lot of those little faint circuits that go off that are thinking, well, what about this? Okay. What about Cassiopeia up in the sky and that, you know, thing? What that has something to do with this? Okay. So your brain's like searching all over the place. When you shut down the analytic mind as it's now not glaring at this problem and you go away, then the adaptive unconscious can start to wander around looking for things. And if they start to get active, it starts to see a possible pattern, a solution to the open loop, then it can start to get hotter. Okay. And it buzzes around and more of those neural circuits fire. It's like a detective in there. And then suddenly it can go kabam. Got it. And that is when you bolt up out of bed and you're like, got it. That's what it is. In a flash, it arrives, you know, just really You're not even thinking about it. It just comes like a lightning bolt. That will happen in dreams. So this is exactly, we believe dreams facilitate a lot of creative problem solving, probably from moving pieces around, actually forcing them around with little blasts of acetylcholine at certain times of the sleep cycle, which cause you to essentially jumble up the elements that you have identified when you are conscious in an analytic process, and essentially making it so disparate parts of the problem may bang into each other when you're asleep. This is very much akin to if you're working on a jigsaw puzzle and you get stumped because you actually don't know what the puzzle is, but you've done a lot of the puzzle and you're just going on little correlational elements of the pieces. You know, these have a little black spot here and that maybe that has to go with those. You don't even know what you're looking at yet. It would be super useful to know what you're looking at, but you don't know what you're looking at. And so what will happen is if you're working on a jigsaw puzzle, people that work on these a lot, they know that if you get stumped, one of the best things you can do is just back away, come back and mix up all the existing pieces that are loose. Just swirl them around for a minute. Just change up where they are. Because when you do that, when you stop and look, you may see something, you may see possibilities and connections that you didn't see before. Okay? That looks to be what sleep actually mechanically engineers in certain stages of sleep. Now, and it's going to turn out that surprisingly often people have had major creative insights in their sleep. So the question is a really good one. I would say I think most of my really surprising insights have almost always come when under two conditions. Number one, I'm working on the problem. So I've been spending some time on the problem. So I may have spent, 2 hours today or 6 hours this week or something. In other words, I've been working on the problem and my brain has open loops all over the place. And it's got dissatisfaction with the fact that those loops are open. And then I have to back away from it. So I back away from it, go shoot a few hoops, talk to Alan. God forbid, not too long. Okay. And pet the cat, go get an acai bowl and go play some basketball, come home later, take a shower. And then suddenly it's like, got it. And it arrives with frustrating unpredictability, but almost, it's a humility of how you cannot drive many creative processes or great ideas. You can't force them through what I call the left brain, or I call the left brain and right brain. This is metaphorical. Left brain is what I call an analytic process. The right brain is what I call a holistic process. We know that that isn't really how it is very well. It's not really built that way. But from the intuitive notion of the right brain being more artistic, intuitive, holistic, essentially an integrative mechanism looking for oftentimes very subtle connections. The feeling of a blast of insight actually appears to be the juxtaposition of two sets of neurons simultaneously firing. And that's when you say, got it, I see how the connection works. You get that all the time. So if you're, if you're doing your bank balance and you can't figure out what's wrong, and then you're like, oh, there it is, boom. Suddenly it's like, oh, I see how the mistake happened. I see why that worked that way. And I see that I haven't completely added up the numbers right now, but I'm almost positive as I'm looking right now, that's about a right amount. And the last two digits, the 9 and the 8 add up to 7, and I knew there was 7 at the end. So kaboom! Suddenly, everything is activated at once. Different neural circuits searching for the pattern, looking for the misunderstanding of causality that has now been identified. So that happens in all kinds of things. But the creative processes, the arts, etc. That's super a super big important tool of the mind, able to see extraordinary and bizarre connections that you would be very difficult to arrive at those connections through an analytic process. So the brain uses both kinds of processes. And when the analytic gets too loud, then the intuitive gets too quiet. And a lot of times we can't hear it. But when we shut down the analytic, suddenly the intuitive can rise and we can hear it. And that's exactly what the questioner was talking about. And it is absolutely real.
Oh my God, that's amazing. So be right back, Dr. Lal. I'm going to go take a hot shower.
Yeah. I think as Jonathan Schooler has talked about this, and he's a professor of psychology somewhere, I think in Santa Barbara. And he says, you know, every single one of his best ideas always came from, he'd go drive out by the beach and he'd park his car and he'd just take a stroll and just strolling by the beach and just sort of, you know, his mind would wander away from whatever it is that he was thinking about. He's just strolling along, just taking in the senses and just getting, you know, a little quiet inner peace, and then kaboom, something happens. So, for me, it's sometimes frustrating, and I'm sure it is for most people that ever work hard on anything, that when you're working hard on something, you want so badly to have the great creative leap. You want to do this. You're like, I've got the time, I'm working really hard, it's important. God, you might even be under a deadline, for God's sake, which is terrible. Notice Jen and I don't have any deadlines. We just have to change the little things.
I wasn't going to say anything, yeah. I'm sure you haven't been asked about it at all.
Oh, no, not me. Well, Jen guards me from that, you know. She's been asked a bunch of times, but people are quiet with me. I think they assume I'm going to be mean. we're going to release a little bit of this. We're going to let, oh gosh, I'm telling the Beat Your Genes people, this is actually only going to be for our shucks. It's only for our Living Wisdom Library, but as we get closer, we're going to let people get peeks of what it is that we've been up to. But at any rate, I need to wander back.
Oh yeah, you were saying that God forbid you're under a deadline.
God forbid you're under a deadline. Yeah. Right. And that now you're forcing the left brain to make the most interesting connections that it can make. You know, that's how you wind up with a Barbara Cartland romance novel. Like the woman, you know, wrote 22 of them in a year. Like, well, we know what those look like. There's no creativity at all. The
formula.
So, yeah, just formulaic. I mean, just ridiculous. So if you're going to do something outstanding and creative, outstanding for you, at the limits of whatever your abilities are, you might be a super creative person that can write something pretty damn good and just force it through the left brain because you just have incredible chops. But if you're going to do your best work, then it's going to require an oscillation between analytic and holistic process. There is no other way to do it. And so I'm just amazed at the process. I've been now writing this book since 2014. And so it's been a 7-year process. I could have forced the action through the left brain and had a pretty damn good book at this point. And I mean, it could have been done 4 years ago. But I'm trying to write, instead of write a good book, I'm trying to write the best book that I can possibly write. And as a result of that, that requires periods of oscillation between intense focus and then back off and then let the right brain take over for a while and see what it comes up with. And I have to tell you, I'm super, super glad that I did it that way and that I did not have a publisher and be under a publisher's deadline. And I can't wait to see some of the work that Jen Hawk is not only doing, but that she's going to be doing in the future. We both have the same spirit about that, and we will. You know, but that's how we're going about it, is an oscillating process. You know, that may not be true if you're in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley will poo-poo that. They'll put 7 electrical engineers in a room and say, "Go at it. Let's come up with a circuit board for XYZ." Okay. That is not the same thing as Bob Dylan coming up with Blowing in the Wind. It's not the same thing. Okay, so the how on earth that guy came up with all the things that he came up with, he didn't sit down and do it linearly. He did it absolutely holistically. That brain was looking at problems that were troubling him and looking at all kinds of things going on in the world, and it just swirled around and swirled around and swirled around, and then boom, there it comes. What a thing, okay? It's a beautiful thing to observe that human beings are capable of that. And so we're all capable of that at different levels. We can't just be, quote, a creative genius. You must have elements of analysis in whatever it is that you're doing. That's part of the game. It's part of what makes the human mind work, you know, in its most exquisite fashion, is an integration between the analytic and the holistic. And so anyway, but that's, we had like six questions we were going
to
answer.
No, that's all right. This is great. It's a good time to remind our listeners that if you have not gone to esteemdynamics.com and become a Living Wisdom Library member, this is a good time to do so, because there's a lot of good stuff. Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk have Q&A sessions there where they talk about, you know, even more topics than we talk about here on video as well. So you get to watch those. So it's a really, really good membership to have.
I was not trying to shill this thing. It just happened by accident.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot where I was.
No, it's perfect.
Okay, no, that's all right. But anyway, so that's the story of that. And there's a couple of good books on this that I found super helpful in helping my understanding. One of them is by a guy named Stephen Johnson, who's one hell of a writer. And he wrote, his book is called Where Good Ideas Come From. And the other book was, I think, I can't remember, Jonathan something. I can't remember his last name, but it's called Imagine. And those two books, amazingly enough, they came out right about the same time, and they are both on the creative process. And amazingly, they cover, I thought, oh, brother, I already read a super comprehensive, you know, brilliant discussion of creative process. What am I going to get out of the second book? And the answer was a whole hell of a lot that wasn't in the first book. In other words, it was amazing looking at exactly the same topic. Two very fine minds had done different research and come about it, you know, and basically synthesized information and come up with ideas about about neural function that were quite different. And all of it looked true to me. It just looked like they had amazingly not covered exactly the same territory. So fabulous. I recommend both of those books, and they're so confusing to me. I have gone back in the last several years looking to read snippets, sure that an idea that was in book one was in book one, and it turned out, no, it was never even discussed in book one. It was in book two. So my head is all, I could not tell you what's in what book. All that I can tell you is that both of them are exceptional books. On the creative process and the question that was asked.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lyle. Shall we do maybe one or two more questions?
Yeah. But do a couple more just for fun. Sure, let's do it.
All right, dear doctors, I've noticed that many people act differently around close friends and family than they do around coworkers and strangers. So how do we know what our true personalities are? For example, I'm the life of the party around people I know very well, but I'm totally shy and quiet around strangers and at work. I'm also quite disagreeable with close friends and family, but highly agreeable with everyone else. Is it my high conscientiousness that causes me to be such a chameleon?
This person sounds like my first cousin is very much like me. Okay, so I'm not the life of any party, but I'm super quiet and avoid social get-togethers like the plague generally.
Dr. Lyle, you're the life of our party.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's why I've never invited, you know. So, but at any rate, the deal is that all you're watching, folks, is you're watching shifts of cost-benefit analyses. So you're not a chameleon, and there isn't, quote, a real personality. There is a real personality that never alters, but it puts itself under different circumstances. So remember what the ultimate design of the organism really is. The proximal design of the organism is to maximize its esteem holdings in the Stone Age village. That's When I say proximal, in other words, that's what you are aware of, and that's clearly what it is that you're up to. What you don't know is that by doing so in the Stone Age, by following those orders from the adaptive unconscious, you will optimize gene survival. Okay, so that's what you're up to. So why would I be different with some group of people than another group of people? For the same reason I'm different from with one person than I am with a second person. Okay, that my personality can be, you know, my behavior, my personality is my personality, but that includes the fact that the personality is, in fact, in other words, behavior is dynamic. Personality is not. So the personality is intractable, but that doesn't mean that human behavior isn't flexible. So as I've said many times, a mafia chieftain with a gun to his head suddenly gets friendly and humble. Okay, why? Because it's the only reasonable move to save your life, and he can run the cost-benefit analysis. He'll get back at the guy later. Okay, so that means literally, I'm different with Alan than I am with Jen quite a bit. It's not that I'm a chameleon. It's that I find myself in very different circumstances with respect to esteem currency. And so, you know, what I can talk about, what we're interested in. So let's suppose I was talking with Alan. Yeah, I have talked to Alan. I've tried to talk to Alan about, you know, freedom and COVID and the world, and he couldn't give a rat's ass. He doesn't care. Alan's like, well, so if they lock us all down, we're in Sonoma County, that's fine. I don't need to leave Sonoma County. It's great. Yeah, his other thing was when it was like, I was like, yeah, you wait till you can't go out to a restaurant without a vax pass. He's like, why would I want to go out to a restaurant? Food's just great at True North. You talk to Jen Hawk about the world being closed down and all this kind of stuff, and she's like ready to cry. Mm-hmm. She has such a tremendous spirit of adventure and a love of freedom and wanting to go and see the world and meet new people and see and do everything. And it's like, whoa, the governments of the world are going to come in and put a wet blanket over the freedom of her life. It's like she just feels like she just recently freaking got left school and now is growing some wings and gets to go and play. She's been waiting to play for a long time, sort of unfettered by that horrible, awful rite of passage called a PhD dissertation. Okay, so, you know, and now she's looking around like, wait a minute, just when I'm getting going here, look what these people, they're wrecking my party. No, so of course the conversations I have with those two people are very different. One of them is like, it's gonna be all right, Jen. No, I'm like with Alan, I'm like, hey, listen, dum-dum, let me hit you over the head and tell you we're in an emergency, dude. Get some emotion going, you know what? We could be in trouble. So this is all whoever's that you're talking to, you are looking at a very different CB about the nature of the interaction, the interchanges, and what is valuable in those transactions. So, you know, if I'm talking to Colin Campbell at something and I'm chatting with him, and then some attractive lady comes up and says, oh, Dr. Lyle, can I ask you something? It's like, hey, Colin, see you later. Nice talking to you, Colin. Maybe I'll circle back around and say hi later. Okay? I.e., cost-benefit. All right? Cost-benefit. That's all you're actually watching there. So you are not a chameleon. You have a personality that evaluates things in a certain way, and those things themselves are highly variable. They're a swirling cauldron of different people and different situations, some of them social and some of them not social, okay? So you can be feeling calm and pleasant, and then somebody's dog is barking, and now you're like all irritated, okay? So there wasn't even people around to observe this, but your feelings now shift. And you may even say, well, it's, you know, the neighbor's got a right to have his dog back there, but I'm really pissed at that dog because I would really like some peace and quiet. So this is not performative. This is just your inherent nature. Somebody else would hear that dog bark, might have a really, you know, phlegmatic, easygoing personality to be like, eh, not that big a deal. Yeah. So, so that's, anyway, that's the story. Your personality isn't changing. Your circumstances are changing. And of course, changing circumstances will lead to different CBs, and those different CBs will lead to different feelings and different behavior. That's the end of the mystery.
Wonderful, Dr. Law. Thank you so much. All right, our final one.
All right. Okay, one more.
Dear doctors, all right. Do other animals besides humans show self-destructive behavior? Why are humans so self-destructive?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a great question, and there's probably several angles to be considered there, but human beings, I mean, animals don't show self-destructive behavior. They can make mistakes. So they can do things. Obviously, they can turn left when they should turn right. They can also have self-destructive, quote, altruistic behavior that is in the benefit of their genes. So that was the great insight of William Hamilton. So animals can do self-sacrificial behavior, which would be self-destructive, but it's not self-destructive for their genetic code. It's the right answer. A mom defending her cubs could get injured and get killed, but it was worth the shot. A bee stinging, you know, an invader kills itself, but may save its DNA-producing queen and the drones and the hive. So from the standpoint of what is in your best interest from evolutionary design, the answer is animals, writ large, systematically, no species engages in self-destructive behavior. The individuals don't do that. They may make mistakes and they miscalculate. They may have bad luck, but it is not self-destructive behavior. Now, humans don't either. Okay? So inside of human beings, when you're watching self-destructive behavior, you're watching some elegant calculus, which may be erroneous, but you're still watching the activation of gene optimization instincts. So the ultimate of self-destructive behavior would be suicide. And you would say, well, how the hell could suicide possibly not be self-destructive? It is the epitome of self-destructive. But let's look at who commits suicides most often. It's elderly people that are penniless and in pain. So that means they are burdens to their family, which means their adult children have less money and time and energy to devote to their children, which is the elderly person's grandchildren, which is their DNA. So they look at this thing, and it may seem like too complicated and too deep of a reach. You may just say, hey, they're in a hell of a lot of pain, okay? And the cost benefit just may say, hey, it's not worth it. There's too much suffering. Okay, that would make sense, because the chronic pain that never heals could be basically telling the organism you are never going to recover, and you are so sufficiently disabled that you are not going to be useful to the tribe. Therefore, you are more cost than you are benefit. Okay, I think that this is very often the case with obviously elderly people. Oftentimes towards the end of their life, oftentimes hurting, and oftentimes without assets. And that this is going to be essentially a calculation that results in self-destructive impulses. This makes sense. It also makes sense when people have possibly suffered a tremendous humiliation. Bernie Madoff's son, for God's sakes, committed suicide. Okay, so that would make sense. In other words, you're thinking your group or you did something terrible to the tribe, and the only way you can atone for it is to kill yourself. And therefore, you may give some honor to the remaining gene devices that are left to you, your sons, your daughters, your cousins, etc. You may, in fact, bolster up or return a little bit of their genetic cachet that was taken from them when you were shamed. Okay, so that's that you could see how the nervous system could run that calculus. Human beings are going to have some of the more extraordinary twists and turns of self-destructive behavior. Chief part of that is going to be things that we see in the ego trap. It's because the other animals are dealing largely with big variables in their survival and reproductive success don't have to do with the opinions that other animals have of them. So their environment, the survival and reproductive variance variables are largely not related to their reputations. When human beings live, their survival and reproductive probabilities are heavily related to what other people think of us. That is why esteem is the chief calculus. It's the chief architect of human motivation, and it is the chief calculus of how happiness is sought. So that's why basically almost all depression, not all of it, almost all depression is the frustration of sought esteem that was not achieved. So when we are puzzled, depressed, frustrated, miserable, rejected, those feelings are feelings that we have competed for esteem and we have fallen short in what is we've achieved. Most of anxiety, some of it's straight survival anxiety. A great deal of anxiety, though, is social anxiety, which has to do with the possibility that we may do something to lose esteem. Somebody may call on us or ask us a question, a little social group at a cocktail party, and we're going to be all frozen up and anxious because we don't want to be a fool and therefore say something stupid and not look articulate, okay? And so people have, i.e., what do they fear losing? Esteem. Because that's true, you're going to find the ego trap being a very interesting process by which people will often do self-destructive behavior, but it's self-destructive in an extremely clever and deceptive way in order to show that we are not trying, because if we try and they observe us and then we fall short of their expectations, then we will lose esteem or status. So I don't believe that the ego trap exists in the animal kingdom. The ego trap is a unique puzzle and problem, and it's an opportunity. The ego trap is an adaptive strategy that says conditions now exist where I am better off not trying at all than I am trying and coming up about where I think I'm going to. So I don't know if anybody's come to the party and written about it and actually analyzed anything comparable to this analysis with Simone Biles. Okay. But that's obviously what happened with Simone Biles, is that she was given too much status and therefore realized she was too likely to lose. Even though she might've had a 50-50 shot at the gold in that event, that's a hell of a lot worse than the 99-1 that was being inferred by the world. And so she ran the calculus and opted out. And so that was a great example of how that would work. Got a lot of sympathy and all that, but you can imagine circumstances where you wouldn't have got sympathy. You would have got a lot of frustration, irritation, criticism, etc. But at the same time, that individual might realize I'm better off with that than with the chance that I had actually wind up not even meddling. And then completely trashing my reputation as, quote, the greatest gymnast of all time. So that's the ego trap winds up being a unique lever inside of human motivational possibility that leads to self-destructive behavior that is in fact engineered at optimizing gene survival. But we can look at it from another perspective and say, whoa, that's really expensive and brutal, which it is. Okay, so, all right. So I think that answers that pretty
yeah.
well.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Lau. That's amazing.
Got it.
It's, I love it when you wander into the weeds about different things. Not that this was the weeds. This was like, you know, this
yeah,
was the
yeah,
entire forest. All good. So, yeah.
All right. Well, very good, Nate.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe.
write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.